author of the week on literary lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
Francesca Kay, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Your third novel, The Long Room, could you introduce it for us?
The Long Room is a story set in 1981, featuring a man called Stephen, who's acutely lonely, but also very sensitive and full, with a head full of poetry, employed to as an eavesdropper, essentially, which means that he spends a great deal of his working life with his ears pressed to the lives of others, and it perhaps distorts his sense of his own life. And when he pursues his own life, it leads him into a very dangerous and dark situation.
Because in one sense, Stephen Donaldson is, an ordinary young man who falls in love.
Completely, yes.
And he falls completely, poetically. It's an amour fou,
you know?
He just falls completely crazily in love.
That's exactly right. An amour fou is exactly what it is.
And all of the things that go with that. He is like falling in love. It is a state of exaltation and craziness, of passion, and that makes you, skews your decisions, blinds you. And he is, so in one sense, it is an ordinary story.
Yes.
Of a man falling in love.
Yes.
But we see it, as you say, it is also in the context, the wider context of the Cold War. IRA bombs are going off in London. Falklands is on the Aki.
Yes.
And yet, it's sort of, we go from that wide angle down through to a keyhole.
Yes, that's a beautiful way of putting it. Yes.
In our view of him.
Yes. Yes, that's a lovely way of describing it. That's exactly right. Out of the wide background, in which a lot of different characters, of course, could fit, and which many of us, including me, lived at the time. So the background is historical and pretty much accurate in that sense. But as you say, I'm using it only really to focus on that one person. I'm using also his employment to focus on him, because it's the ideal environment in which that madness, as you say, that amour fou, which is exactly right, is intensified by the isolation that he experiences both in his own private life and in his working life, where his sense of what other people are doing becomes very distorted.
And you have been noted, and rightly so, for your level of detail. And to me it felt, because we can see, as the reader, we can see things that Stephen is blinded to. And it's sort of a bus wreck in slow motion. And you see every detail, because every tsunami is made up of little drops of water. And you've given us a lot of the little drops of water that end up in this, which we can see coming, but he can't.
Yes,
crash.
Yes.
And it is beautifully filled in and seems inexorable.
Yes. I mean, the seeds of his own destruction are sown pretty early, and it isn't going to be a surprise that there isn't a happy ending. Mm. There is no way that he's going to be extricated out of that, and let alone have what he wants to have. But that self-destructive element is in lots of people, isn't it? A kind of plunge, and he's taking it to a greater extreme. But there is perhaps a sense that I just need to do something to change my life, and even if it's going to be essentially suicidal, not literally suicidal, but a dangerous thing to do, he's just going to do it. So yes, absolutely. And the detail, I think, is probably necessary. I hope not too much detail, because I'm not very good at the kind of massively huge picture. But I think that you do need the anchoring detail, the sort of the tiny bits of reality to make the imagined reality have a proper life of its own, which is why I put in lots of stuff about, you know, office procedures and the names of things and so on. Because if you believe in the whole situation and you believe in the picture that is being painted, then I hope also the reader will feel confident in the reality of the people in the novel.
Radio Gorgeous, online, on your phone, on a podcast, or on your tablet. Listen anywhere, anytime.
Well, I think we're always interested in what motivates people. And it has to... You can clearly see what motivates him because he is in context.
Mm.
And to me, humans are humans and humans haven't changed. And I think you can see in him also a person who we're wondering now what, and I'm not saying in any way he is a suicide bomber, but what prompts these young men to do these things? And here is a young man who does something, I would say, in the context of his life, equally crazy.
Well, that's extremely perceptive, Donna, because that's exactly... I'm very interested in that, what makes people do things. But we're all very interested now in what makes those particular young men do what they are particularly doing, and some women too. So this isn't just a, you know, this isn't a gender-biased thing entirely. Certainly, if Stephen had been a different kind of person in a different background, and I'm not sure about the suicide bomber, but yes, possibly the kind of person who flips and opens a machine gun onto a hospital ward full of patients, or don't in any way wish to trivialize real tragedy by comparing it with fiction, but that we have all seen with horror the kind of apparently normal but slightly sort of sad loser, but normal. I mean, not people who are not psychopathic, who suddenly flip and assassinate large quantities of their classmates. Stephen is not that kind of person because he's actually a gentle person at heart, and perhaps has just read really far too much literature and not had enough living. But yes, you are absolutely right. In an extreme situation, that's exactly what would happen if mm-hmm. people are isolated. You know, loneliness is a dangerous thing, isn't it?
Yes, it seems a particularly potent combination of loneliness and a secret passion,
yes,
that sort of exalts you. You know, because he's in a world, he sees how the intelligence community is operating, you know, under the skin and under the eyes of the normal citizen. So he sees behind that veil, you know, and yet he has, even within that, he has this secret.
Yes.
You know, that you know, he knows the way. And it really, it seems like a pretty lethal cocktail.
Yes, he does have a strong sense of self, of self-belief. I mean, he isn't, I'm glad he doesn't come across as sounding in the slightest bit unhinged, because I certainly didn't think, feel that he was. But he does, and he is surrounded by people for whom, who professionally are using reality in ways that they feel are useful, contingent for the time, expedient rather than genuine. And that is exactly what happens to him. Why not?
Yeah.
And he's seen it.
Yes.
He's seen it in his own life, and how things can change, and why not him? He's a clever young man. There's nothing wrong with him.
Mm.
He looks at himself in the mirror and he says, well, you know, why not me?
Mm-hmm.
Why somebody else? That's the other thing, isn't it? It's the comparison.
Yes.
With the much more superficially confident, or perhaps genuinely confident.
Yeah.
That is.
And you know, also at the time, which I think was even a stronger structure than it is now, class.
Very much.
Education, background, you know, and how those are strictures that are sometimes hard to shake off.
Yes.
Yes. Your belief in them holds you in
yes.
them.
Yes. Yes, well, I went to university, the same university as my character, though a little bit later. But that whole time during, you know, the 70s, which was a much more stratified society, really, and where you could see absolutely the first time that the different groups had actually met together in a, you know, when more people went to the kind of schools where their right. daddies and their granddads and everybody else went, and then they just were released into Oxford exactly with all their same sort of their cohorts and met the others who tended not to come in such large cohorts because drawn from a greater number
those
and a greater
variety
of those
people.
Grammar school people
and jumped you know, up
yes and it so it was a meeting of different sort of expectations and cultures good for both perhaps but and mostly constructive and I hope for most people a perfectly happy experience but not for all of them because the you know the comparisons the degrees the levels of inequality to do with who had enough money and who was better looking. This, of course, was a time when men at that university vastly outnumbered women. So there was a real survival of the fittest struggle there going on.
Radio Gorgeous, the sexist station where you'll only hear the female voice.
I don't want to give the impression that this is in any way a dour read or that it's, you know, because there was one thing I will not be giving any plot away. But that I was laughing out loud and, you know, poking my husband. And so he thought he was also treated to all that. Who hasn't read the book has been read the section of the book. When Stephen's mother is, there's a constant internal debate with her about whether she should get a freezer or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this big,
mm-hmm.
big question in her mm-hmm. mind. And one of her reasons for not getting a freezer is the big question of, you know, what happens to the food, you know, say you drop dead, and what happens to the food you cooked, you know, would you throw it out, and whether, it depends what it was, depends how good the cook was, you know, a frozen peas, fine, but a cheese and onion tart, and, which also really helped to evoke, the character of Coralie just absolutely anchors and fixes Stephen in a time and place.
Well, you can't believe how happy it makes me that you laughed, because I'm quite often accused of, you know, writing things that make people sad. but I think there are quite a lot of jokes in everything that I've written. It's just that you have to look for them a bit. But yes, I mean, when you know, within the faint melancholy of the book, and then no, you know, that there's no doubt that at the end you probably weren't laughing. But yes, in between, and some of the things that Stephen does are comic too, the situations he finds himself in, but certainly because Coralie doesn't have any sort of sense, she's not censoring herself, so it's exactly what she's thinking about, the kind of trivial detail or important detail that we all think about but we just don't usually tell other people.
That must have been fun to write for that very reason.
She kind of wrote herself, really. I just could hear her voice completely, and I really felt that, you know, she was in the room just chatting and chatting and chatting. The question was to turn her off. That's enough now.
Well, at least somebody's listening to Coralie, because no one else in her life did or does. So at least she was heard. You know, she's heard through
this.
Yeah,
was she? Yeah.
Well, and also there's a lot of humor just in the very setup of the sort of everydayness of you know, Stephen's office life. You know, because it's all cloak and dagger, and yet, you know, it's still the same office politics, and
yes.
you know, and the Christmas party and the Secret Santa, and
Well, I imagine that, however, a cloak and dagger, and I don't know how much cloak or dagger there might be in the reality, but whatever the reality, whatever you are doing, unless, you know, that's the kind of thing that happens when people are in a group, you know. It's exactly the who hasn't washed the coffee mugs kind of, I mean, this is what life is made up of, isn't it? Daily life.
Yeah.
Wherever you are, a lot of quite tedious detail.
Yes. Just, it's not all. It's not all.
No, it's not all action or even emotion.
Yeah, it did sort of remind me, I was listening on This American Life, the American radio show, and they were talking about first days, and this cop comes on, you know, and he's a small town cop in, you know, in New England, you know, Connecticut somewhere. And he thought it was all going to be car chases and cops and robbers and all exciting. And one of his first days, he's on traffic detail. It's cold. And his mother drives by and says, "Why aren't you wearing a hat?"
Yes, lovely.
He was like, So this is being a cop. It's just like being in high school.
I actually love listening to people talking about the actual detail. And if you can ever get anybody to tell you exactly what, for example, they are making for their child's Christmas fair, or exactly what happened to them in the supermarket, especially if the people you don't know terribly well, because you know it doesn't have a context. It's really interesting. The details of people's lives are fascinating, because you then get a little insight into character without necessarily being prurient or probing. It's just fascinating, and I love even in sort of the kind of, I'm quite addicted to all these Scandi noir kind of things, but I really want quite a lot less of the story and quite a lot more, what she's doing by herself in the evening, and whether she's going to have anything to eat, and whether she knows how to cook, and the domestic details, especially of such a very compelling, sympathetic character as that one is, just really fascinate me.
Well, so you as a writer, you are a collector of those details in the same way that, Stephen is a listener, and hearing the details of other people's lives.
Yes, I mean, that has a faintly kind of spooky sound, as though I go around with a notebook.
Oh.
No, I don't know. I know you don't mean it. That's not, sort of.
Do you?
Putting all my friends. No, I mean, these are mostly imagined details. It isn't that. Occasionally, one hears a line which is so great, like an old lady the other day said to me, "It ain't gossiping weather." Standing at that, there are lines that you couldn't help but want to note because they're beautiful in themselves. But I don't think fiction is made up of a sort of jigsaw puzzle of real bits of observation. It's made up of thinking about, trying to imagine oneself into other people's heads and then inventing the detail of their particular lives rather than putting real detail into imagined lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel that. But yes, I am a writer. And Stephen is exactly doing that. And Stephen is like a writer in some ways too, because of course he's making that narrative.
Yes, he breathes such imagination.
Yes.
Into the silences.
Yes.
And into what he can't see.
Yes.
He fills it in
yes.
with such incredible detail.
Yes.
Fueled also by his Oxford education, and all the poetry that he absorbed.
That's exactly right. He's writing the story in the same way that I was writing the story.
Mm-hmm.
He's making, and as his story removes itself even further from what he can actually measurably, demonstrably prove, it becomes more of a fiction.
Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah.
I wanted to ask you about your path to writing, because you didn't go directly to writing. And I was wondering about sort of the idea of giving yourself permission to write. Being such a huge appreciator of some phenomenal literature.
Yes, that's a very good question, and that really is, it's three-quarters of the answer why I started so late. Yes, I mean, of course, when I was much younger, I wrote lots of poems and short stories and probably still have them in a box that will never, ever see the light of day. I was interested in the ways of using words, but you are right, the more one reads, in a way, the more sort of humble I think one has to feel. Yes, I mean, why you read Middle of March and think, why would anybody ever, or To the Lighthouse, why would anybody ever write another novel you've read that? It's done. What's more there is there to do. And the other thing, I suppose, is that, I mean, there are lots of very great, very young writers, but for me, I think I just needed to be old enough to feel I had something to say. Not a very bold or grand message, but something that hadn't been said in exactly the same way by somebody else. Otherwise, I'd have just felt a sort of even greater sense of incompetence than I already do. I hope that the sort of craft does definitely get better with age, because you just have more experience, you know, that there isn't... You've seen more words, or heard more words, or used more words, and I hope it gets better, because that would be an incentive, wouldn't it, to carry on, if there is a sort of little improvement each time, rather than a decline.
Yeah. Well, each of your novels have been, your first novel won the Orange Prize
for new writing.
Your second novel was longlisted for the Orange Prize, so fingers crossed, Bailey, here we come.
don't. It's best.
I'm not jinxing it. I have nothing to say. I have no influence whatsoever.
I think it's very much better just not to think. The book is just out there. Let it. I hope it takes it wings and flies off, but I'm not going to worry about that. But yes, for the first novel, it was a fantastic piece of luck, because not only did it obviously help in terms of self-confidence, it stopped me thinking, which I did feel very strongly even before it was published and even a little bit afterwards, that this could be a great act of delusion. You know, how dare you think that you can write a book? But if somebody gives you a prize for it, then at least you know that some other people clearly think it was all right that you did it. So that was wonderful. And of course it helps in terms of the future, and at least you'll have a little tiny say in it, because somebody's taking you seriously. Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, you have the second novel.
Yes. Yes.
And how did you handle those?
Well, I mean, the whole thing, it should get easier. I mean, once you've done it once, you know, like childbirth, you know, it should be, by the time
different
you've done it...
Different every time.
Different every time. And no easier. But the expectations, both of oneself and, of course, of other people, but especially of oneself. As I was saying, you know, I would like to think that not necessarily each book is better, because that's sort of qualitative judgment, but that there is some development in voice or in complexity that happens. So, you know, I want to set the bar for myself quite high, but it doesn't make it at all. Contemplating the blank page doesn't get any easier, yeah. I have found.
Starting over again
and thinking... You know, there's a point, my son, who's a composer, made a very good analogy. There was a point when I was completely bogged down. I'm literally bogged down. I couldn't go backwards and I couldn't go forwards with this book. I just thought, but I was too far, you know, it's okay to throw away 20,000 words, but 35,000 words, just binning, it does feel, you know, just the housewife in me says that's terribly, terribly, yes, profligate. And he said it was like if you're trying to write a piece of counterpoint, you can't tell what's wrong with it until you've finished. And then you go back and you'll find the note that is wrong. So I kept reminding myself of that because you know, music and the sort of structure was important in the book, that if I actually just held my nerve and finished it, then I would know where I needed to change things. But, you know, it's... at 45,000 words, it didn't feel that quite that straightforward.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, okay, so now I'm going to commit myself to binning 100,000 words. Like,
well,
how much more
actually,
squandrous does that sound?
Yes, well, probably sometimes that has to happen, but...
Must be saved.
Not yet, next time maybe.
How has that it's because you are such an avid reader, how has having readers changed? Has that changed your reading experience?
Yes. Having readers is, I mean, just that nobody tells you beforehand what a delight. I mean, wow, it's so exciting when you actually meet people who don't know you but do know what you've written and often have such brilliantly different ideas about it.
Yeah, it becomes theirs.
It becomes theirs, and I like that. I really like that. I really love sometimes go and talk to book groups, small book groups, and they forget you're there, and they argue with each other about, but she wouldn't have done that, or, no, I don't think that she really liked him. And I love that, because then you know that, there's a sort of incarnation going on.
Well, and then and you've moved them. You have made these characters real.
Yes, I mean, that's the council. You know, that's what one aspires to. It may not always work, but that's the... So I love that. I love that sense of readers taking ownership. It hasn't changed the way I write, but it has made me much more aware of other people's possible interpretations, so that I'm not quite so solipsistic about either my own reading. I mean, I used to be rather kind of snobby and purist, and now I'm still quite snobby and purist, but I can see the really good things in things that I would not necessarily have chosen. So I hope it's made me a bit more broad-minded. Certainly made me very, very grateful that there are readers.
Thank you so much, Francesca Kay.
Thank you, Donna.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us, contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com, and to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. Commencing countdown, engines on. 3, 2, check ignition, 1. And may God's love lift be off. With you. This is ground control to Major Tom. Tom to ground control, I'm stepping through the door, and I'm floating in a most peculiar way, and the stars look very different today, for here am I sitting in a tin can. We'll be right back.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production, produced and presented by Donna Freed, edited by Bree Forer.